up in the morning and out for school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule, American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass, working your fingers right down to the bone. The guy behind you won't leave you alone.
Hello, everyone. My name is Leonie Hameson. Welcome to our show, Talk Out of School, on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM, where we focus on issues affecting public schools here in New York City at the state level and nationally. Our show is also available for download as a podcast. Today, we have two guests. First, I'll speak with Alice Mulligan, a pre-K director and head of CBOs for Equity, who'll tell us what her school reopening was like and what help she received and what help she didn't receive from the Department of Education. Then I'll be talking to Tom Liam Lynch, Director of Education Policy for the Center for New York City Affairs and Editor-Chief of Inside Schools, who will explain their new project to enable parents to share information about their schools and their concerns about the reopening plan. Tom also has expertise in online learning, and I'll ask him how he thinks it could be improved from the version last year to help students learn and keep them engaged. Towards the end of the show, I hope to have time to take calls from listeners to hear from you what your questions and concerns are. Schools reopened across the state last week, though in New York City this was delayed by a week of teacher preparation, and today remote orientation is supposed to begin for all New York City students. Next week there will be part-time in-person learning for those students that have opted in. Meanwhile, during the first week, 55 New York City teachers tested positive for COVID, raising some alarms, though, as the mayor pointed out, that was only 0.23% of the 17,000 or so who were tested. Yet teachers in many schools are resisting entering their buildings, saying the cleaning, the supplies, and or the ventilation is not sufficient to make them feel safe. One of the biggest problems is that principals say they still don't have enough teachers to make the blend of in-person and remote classes work, as the system devised by DOE essentially requires three times as many full-time staffers as previously, one to teach full-time remote students, one to teach the part-time blended learning students when they're at home, and another for the part-time in-person students. Though the DOE said they've hired or reassigned 2,000 more teachers and administrators to schools, the principals union say that schools need at least 10,000 for the scheduling to work. What's especially perverse is because of the constrained budgets, some schools have been forced to excess some of the teachers and counselors and librarians they already had on staff. In order to compensate for the staffing shortages, the UFT agreed with the DOE that class sizes for the blended remote learning students could double to as many as 64 to 68 students per class. Then late last night, the night before remote learning was to begin, the DOE announced that the blended learning students would not necessarily receive the 1 to 2 hours of live teaching that they were promised when they're home. While some activist groups argued schools shouldn't reopen at all until there were no COVID cases citywide for at least 2 weeks, and others said we should wait until we had universal health care and free child care for all, throughout this debate and controversy, I have believed that the DOE should do everything they can to offer at least some students the chance to interact with their teachers in person, given how essential live human interaction is to many kids' academic and emotional development. Moreover, in New York City, the positivity rates have been low at about 1% for a month or more, and unlike elsewhere in the state, both social distancing and mask wearing will be required in our schools. In New York City, all schools will be shut down if positivity rates reach 3%, whereas the state benchmark for automatic closure is 5%. Other countries with fewer restrictions have reopened schools without seeing a rise in transmission, and according to the DOE, the rec centers that opened in March for the children of essential workers had no major COVID breakouts, even though they opened at the height of positivity. Yet, unfortunately, the city has so far failed to publicly release the relevant data. But in any case, planning for reopening has been so late and so incoherent, it's shameful. The DOE had nearly 6 months to come up with a rational plan and has failed. Today, we have two guests who I hope will shed light on some of these issues. First, I'm going to hear from Alice Mulligan. Alice is the executive director of Our Savior's Lutheran Preschool in Brooklyn and head of CBOs for Equity. Alice, are you there?
Yes, I am, Lainey. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. I hear that you just had an emergency and almost couldn't make it this morning. Can you explain?
Well, we just had our first symptomatic child on site. So 30 minutes before I was to have this call with you, protocols had to be put in place. And I'm pleased to say that it did work well. The child had a very runny nose, and as we all know, that's one of the symptoms of COVID. So I was able to get our isolation bag, and I suited it up. The child had her mask on at that point, and we waited outside the building for the mom to come and pick her up.
So how many four-year-olds and how many three-year-olds does your school serve? And the four-year-olds are part of the city-run pre-K for all program, is that right, while the three-year-olds are privately paid for?
Yes, Lainey. We've been part of Universal Free Kindergarten in New York City since 1999, and we used to serve 72 children, pre-K children, full-time on-site. While we still are serving 72, only 38 are fully enrolled in the school building at this point. The rest are blended learners as well as fully remote learners. In addition, we have our three-year-old program, which was, you know, quite large, 45 children in the past. We're down to just 15 at one, only on-site at one time. So our numbers are definitely a little over 50% capacity.
Is that because you don't have space to have the social distancing, or is that because fewer of the three-year-olds in particular, the parents signed on for pre-K this year?
It's a little of both, Lainey. We used to be permitted to have 18 children in a pre-K class, but the city wound that back to 15. But even at that, we only have 10 children in class at one time. Our three-year-old program, though, is somewhat different. Parents were very concerned about enrolling their children in a program during this COVID pandemic. So our enrollment numbers are very, very low in that program.
So you started preschool for in-person learning when?
A week ago today, September 9th. That was our date that we had set all along, and we were able to open up on time.
Can you tell us what preparations you made before reopening and what help you got from DOE to do so?
I'd be more than happy to. There was so many things that we had to get in place. And we did start in late June. And honestly, Lainey, we had to make our own plans as we couldn't get any answers from the Division of Early Childhood, from operations, from instruction, from policy. So even though we kept asking for guidance and guidance on how to do blended learning, guidance on how many children would be permitted in person, we did not get any answers. So beginning in June, we began to make our own plans, and it was quite extensive. I mean, we are an older building. Our windows had been sealed shut for at least 30 years, so we worked with a company to get our windows reopened. We had to replace some. We had to do maintenance on our air conditioning. We retrofitted all the faucets in all of our bathrooms and sinks so they're touchless. Some of our rooms do not have sinks in them, so we did purchase portable sinks as well as outdoor sinks. We have two outdoor spaces that are fully enclosed, so we have sinks in the outdoors as well. We were very concerned about acquiring PPE because, as everybody remembers, it was such all through the spring, it was very hard to get these. So we have struggled with getting those, and Councilman Justin Brannan and Senator Gonardis were very helpful. They were able to make some donations, so we do have a very limited supply right now of gloves and masks. Another thing that we did that we're really liking is we did purchase a daily health app that all of our parents have to conduct by 7 o'clock in the morning, and they have to answer a series of questions, and that will give them either the green light that they can attend school or the red light that they can't. And we have found that to be very useful. What we like about this app too is that it, if we do have a case of COVID in our building, contract tracing can be very easily done. We also purchased numerous thermometers, plastic barriers for our offices and staff areas. And then there was just a lot of talking with parents. That was, I have to say that, Lainey, I found that to be really key. As often as I was asking Department of Ed and Department of Health for answers, parents were asking me at the same time. And after a while, the response, I don't know, was just not working. So I began to hold a series of town hall virtual meetings with our families that we could ask questions and, you know, hash out the details of what our reopening will look like. And I have to say, I thought that was pretty helpful. So, you know, we've trained our staff in sanitation. And through all of that, we've really been able to get this building up and running. What I will say is that, you know, we have yet to receive anything from the Department of Ed, and we've been asking, and we don't have any supply of PPEs. We don't have isolation gowns or masks for children or cleaning supplies. We do have, we've purchased some on our own, but we're going to need more.
And of all the purchases, the renovations that you made, did you get reimbursed from DOE? Are you going to be reimbursed from DOE?
Well, they were a little back and forth about that over the summer in their bulletins, but the most recent word, and it's been so disappointing, is that they will not reimburse any center for any COVID-related expenses. And that just was so disheartening for us because we really struggled to get it right for our families and staff. I don't think any of the things that we have done are unreasonable. And to be told, I mean, we've at this point have spent over $7,000 in a budget that already has a huge deficit, and to be told that they're not going to reimburse us, they said because they will be supplying these, but, you know, we're open. We can't operate. At this point, we felt we just couldn't wait for them. So it is very disappointing to hear the Department of Ed say this.
At one point, didn't DOE also promise that they would supply nurses to pre-K centers? What happened with that?
Well, yeah, you know, the mayor did announce, I forget when, maybe it was in August, that he did say every building would have a nurse, and we were absolutely thrilled. I mean, we have, you know, the majority of pre-K for all children, they are all Department of Ed children, and they're all in centers like ours, community-based organizations, the vast majority of these. And poor assuming on my part, I thought nurses would be provided for these children as well. And it was very disheartening to find out that that was not the case. We had a report to the Department of Ed how we would handle symptomatic children, and we kept saying, this is why we need to have a nurse. We were told that wouldn't happen. Instead, they would offer us a 24-hour hotline that we could speak to a nurse. But honestly, in the case like we had today, I did not need to speak to a nurse about a child who was showing symptoms with a runny nose. The Department of Ed told us that we had to assign the job of who would be in isolation with the symptomatic child to a staff member. And, Lainey, there was absolutely no way I was going to ask anybody on my staff to do anything like that. It just was out of the question. So that was my job, and that's what I did this morning, and I have a feeling I'll be doing that quite a bit in the coming months.
So what's interesting to me is that in the K-12 schools, mask wearing is required, but not apparently at the CBO pre-K centers, even those that participate in universal pre-K like yours. Can you explain why?
Well, early on during the summer, New York State Department of Health had said that children who are the ages of the children that we serve did not have to wear masks while on school property. And that was, you know, and I was getting, we did a lot of surveying of families, and we did hear a lot of back and forth from families. Some did not want their children in masks, some did. I was very surprised to see on the first day of school the number of children who did have masks on. The first few days we said it was optional as per New York State, But we just got new guidance on Friday saying that we were, that the DOE and the DOH was really suggesting that we make an effort to help children learn to wear masks. So I did send out an email to our families, and the next day, I'm going to say nearly every child came in with a mask on. The only one who didn't, the father said it blew away on the way into school. So I do see that. I do feel going forward all of the children will have masks on, and I do feel a lot better about that.
Oh, that's good. I know that, yeah. I spoke to one of the teachers at the rec centers over the summer, mm-hmm. and she was a pre-K teacher teaching 3- and 4-year-olds, and she was surprised at how readily the kids actually did adapt to wearing masks, and it didn't seem to be a huge imposition or a problem for them. They were very adaptable. So I hope that works out.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate you taking the time, especially given the emergency that you faced this morning. I would love it if you could come back later in the year and tell us how the school year is proceeding and whether you've gotten any supplies, PPE or whatever, from the DOE and how it's going. I'd also really be interested to hear about blended and remote learning for pre-K kids and how that's evolving over time.
Because.
Yes. Thank you again, Alice. I thank you for your work, and good luck today, and talk to you soon.
Thank you, Lainey. Bye now.
This is Lainey Hameson, host of Talk Out of School on WBAI-FM 99.5 or WBAI.org. Our show is also available as a podcast. But in any case, please consider becoming a WBAI buddy to Talk Out of School by logging into givetowbai.org or by calling 516-620-3602. We really do rely on your support. Now I'd like to bring in Tom Liam Lynch. Tom is the Director of Education Policy for the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School. He's also the Editor-in-Chief of Inside Schools, and he used to work for DOE in designing their online learning platform program called iLearn. Now, hi, Tom, are you there?
Hi, Lainey, I am here.
Oh, great. Thank you for being here. First, can you tell us a little bit about Inside Schools and the new project that you started?
Sure thing. Inside Schools was begun nearly 20 years ago by Clara Hemphill, and it provides independent reviews of New York City schools, as well as other resources like a guided search tool that literally walks families through a school selection process. In the wake of COVID-19, it was clear that New York City families were going to need some incredible support moving into the fall. So we spent the summer designing what we're calling Inside Schools Plus. And Inside Schools Plus is a free community for New York City families, including groups that families can join around shared topics, and also formally designed like online classes, again, specifically aimed at New York City families.
So you have, I noticed, a course, an online course that parents can take to help them support their kids with remote learning. Can you briefly tell us what the course consists of?
Sure thing, no problem. So whereas like the groups in Inside Schools Plus are more like organic spaces for families to exchange information and ask questions, the classes space, as we call it, is meant to provide more of those formally designed learning experiences. So the first class that we launched last week, I designed and am facilitating. It's called How to Learn Online at Home. And it covers some of the background context regarding online learning in New York City. It also looks at how schools are responding to COVID with remote learning. And then it offers lots of concrete information and tools to help families maximize their child's online learning experience. So, for example, giving some of the background, like you mentioned, iLearner earlier, which we can talk a little bit more about later, understanding how the city has engaged with online learning historically and understanding their current state provides some really useful context for families to better appreciate what school principals and teachers are grappling with right now. In addition to that, you know, learning just a little bit about how children have different, you know, kind of multiple intelligences, and there's not one way to learn. Knowing that, you know, there are some concrete ways to schedule your child's day, or honestly, like, there are concrete ways, like, places to put the router in your home that will help, like, with bandwidth needs. All of those kinds of things are covered in an effort to help provide families not just some background context, but also some hands-on practical strategies.
Can you tell us something about your own background? I looked you up. You were a professor of educational technology, and before that, you actually used to work at DOE and help them implement the iLearn NYC program, which you just mentioned, which is, I guess, the DOE's online learning platform. Is that right?
Yeah, so let me give a little bit of background in terms of some of the different hats I've worn, and then we can talk specifically about iLearn for sure. So I taught English and technology for 6 years here in the city first, and then after that time I joined the central offices as they were launching an initiative under the Bloomberg Klein administration called the Innovation Zone. And when I was there, I led the implementation of iLearn NYC. So I started as like an implementation manager and then moved into their director of implementation role. iLearn at that time was in about 120 schools. And then after the work with iLearn and as I started transitioning into more of an academic role, I architected and supported the implementation of WeTeach NYC, which is the city's digital resource repository and online space for teachers. So during that time, I was at Tweed at working for Central. I was finishing my doctorate in education, and then I transitioned into, as you mentioned, that education technology professor role. And during that work, I worked a great deal with pre-service teachers, especially New York City teaching fellows. I was in schools a lot, in addition to doing the kind of typical, you know, professorial academic work. And in addition to all those things, I've also done quite a bit of work in the K-12 computer science education space, specifically around developing methods for embedding computer science into middle and high school English and English language arts classes. In terms of iLearn, which you mentioned, and I know that this summer iLearn was sort of featured for the city's online learning summer school, iLearn has an interesting history. And so, you know, iLearn emerged around 2009. It was tied up in one. It was there was the Joel Klein's kind of emphasis on and prioritization of innovation and creation of the innovation zone. In addition to that, there was also kind of on the heels of that, there was Race to the Top money that was also being applied for. And so there was all of that was sort of like was sort of intertwined. And iLearn, the idea behind iLearn was as follows. So prior to iLearn, and this is 2009, 10, 11 iLearn, prior to iLearn, an individual school principal, if they wanted to make online courses available to their students, so whether it was for foreign language or credit recovery or an AP class they couldn't offer, and those tended to be those kind of peripheral needs tended to be the ways in which school started, what would happen is a principal would essentially have to choose from any one of dozens of online learning companies. But the way the business model worked was like the principal would have to essentially purchase an entire course catalog from that one company, even if they just wanted one of their classes. They'd have to essentially like go all in with the company. So what iLearn was intended to do was to create a space where a principal could essentially say, like, I want this AP, you know, history class from this company, and I want this credit recovery course from this one, and I have a student who's absolutely infatuated with German. Like, you know, we want to be able to make that one German class available from this other company. And so in order to do that, the city had to develop a very complex kind of intermediary platform that all of these other companies would plug into. And that would also plug into what are usually very archaic, you know, Department of Education systems around student enrollment and scheduling and things like that. So that's how iLearn started. And let me pause there because that was a lot of me. That was a lot of me talking.
Yeah. So I'm trying to understand it myself. So essentially, what iLearn was a collection of actually available online courses that the DOE could acquire as a group or as a collection for principals without principals having to search for them themselves and or pay for them themselves. Is that the, is that right?
That's fair, yeah. So, like, thinking of iLearn less as, like, a standalone platform, though it could be used that way. Its original architecture was really about providing, like, you have to understand, like, if you're an external company, let's say if you're an external company and a district upstate, like, decides they want to work with you, you know, you work directly with that district to plug into their student information system, their attendance system, their scheduling system. And it can be a very seamless experience for districts in terms of, like, all of their, you know, they have Google Classroom, they have this online learning platform. All of that stuff kind of works relatively neatly together. With working with the city, it doesn't work that way. It's actually because the city is so big and because it's centrally managed in terms of these information systems, it means it's actually, it can be really, really hard for a company to work seamlessly with a school. And so iLearn was trying to solve for that to some extent. iLearn was also trying to help principals out in terms of not having them locked into a contract with an entire company when they really just wanted a course or two. So it was also trying to loosen up the and make more efficient the purchasing models that were reps that came to digital content and that sort of thing.
What kind of quality control was there about the courses that would be offered through iLearn?
Yeah. The quality, just it's just like with textbooks, honestly, right? It's like some of the courses have some really interesting, thoughtful content. Some of them don't. Quite a number of them don't. And really what makes a lot of these courses most effective is usually when you have just, you know, usually when you have a teacher who can go through and say, oh, well, this you know, this unit works really well. Or I want to supplement this part over here, or I want to do that. So iLearn, as it was designed, iLearn actually was moving toward that, where it wasn't just the teacher would get locked into a particular, like an entire class exactly as it had been designed by a private company. It was actually, iLearn was making headway towards allowing teachers to take out parts of content and to essentially kind of put together their own version, just like they would from a textbook if they were using it in the classroom. The quality control.
So essentially, DOE yeah. Central did, yeah. There was no centralized quality control, or there was.
There was a team, an iLearn NYC team, which included a curriculum director, and there were several mechanisms and ways to get feedback from teachers and principals. This again is in like 2009, 2010, on which courses were being procured and which ones were strongest. But no one would ever say that those courses were, you know, of such great quality that you could, you know, integrate it into the system, turn all, you know, flick a light switch, and everything would be grand.
So reports were over the summer, as I'm sure you heard, that there were initially lots of technical glitches for students and teachers trying to log on to iLearn. And then it turned out about a quarter of kids assigned never logged on at all. According to Chalkbeat, some students felt the platform was composed of dull, standardized assignments that culminated in multiple choice tests or writing assignments with little or no feedback. What's your view on what went wrong, if anything?
Yeah, and I would say, and I think Chalkbeat's done a great job of covering quite a bit of this over the last few months. I think clearly things went wrong, and there's a few aspects to it. So, you know, first, like, online learning requires, like, a thoughtful planning process from, you know, the curriculum that's used to the support for the teachers. And by support for the teachers, that means helping them become familiar with the curriculum and make modifications just as they would with traditional curricular materials. It means helping them become familiar with the actual, like, teaching and learning environment, including the way in which, like, some fairly sophisticated, like, analytics and things like that can be employed. It also means understanding just, again, this is just good teaching. Like, you also want to understand really well what your assessments are and why you're assessing what you're assessing. So again, it's not, none of this is a light switch, or it's not a switch that can be turned on and off just like, you know, just like that. It is worth noting that there is a little bit of a switch effect where, depending on the licenses and contracts that the city still has with different companies, like, there might be entire course catalogs that can be turned on and off. But, you know, currently, I think the the city does not have a dedicated digital learning leader or infrastructure. Meaning, if you look at the most current org chart of the city school system, you're not going to find like a single person you can point to and say, oh, this is the person who understands with sophistication and nuance what digital learning requires. That person does not exist on the org chart, nor is there a clear office or team that is responsible for that. Not just folks who are great with academics, but folks who understand, you know, the intersection of academics and of digital learning and educational technologies. So, you know, while I do support the idea of the city having a centralized learning management solution like iLearn, but I support it in being, you know, properly funded and really thoughtfully implemented. And what we saw and heard this summer suggests that the way it was used was more of a quick solution without adequate planning and support. So the idea that there were so many hiccups mm-hmm. in logging in or that there weren't mechanisms set up to ensure that, you know, that not just multiple quizzes were being used, let's say, with schools. It looks like it was probably rushed. And there's probably some reason for that. The reason being, I think one of the things the city learned almost certainly in the spring was that because they haven't had much of a digital learning strategy, it means that every, you know, all of their 1,800 schools were doing their own thing when it came to the instructional technologies they were using. The most obvious example of that is the fact that, like, each school had its own Google Classroom set up based on its own domain that it procured and set up, like, at the school level. No other district in the state works that way. Individual schools don't go out purchasing their own domains and setting up their own, you know, their own Google Classroom or Google Apps accounts. So what happens, though, if you're Central, if you're Tweed, and you're looking at this, you just realize that, like, you actually have no bird's eye view of your online learning or remote learning infrastructure. Like, you're relying on 1,800 schools to self-report to you who's logging on and, you know, and all of those kinds of things. Not to mention, you don't have any sort of bird's eye view in terms of what instructional quality looks like. So my hunch would be that when they discovered that in spring and they hit summer, they said, look, we also have this iLearn NYC. We own it already. It's been used before. There's a small team that kind of keeps the lights on. Let's try this for summer school because at least it's a centralized solution and we'll have data, like basic data on what's going on. So I suspect something like that was the conversation. But, you know, Lainey, also, like, the pandemic might have been unprecedented, but the city's preparedness for online learning, like, was not. It's actually quite precedented, right? Meaning they've had a platform and a team in place for over a decade that was in title charged with understanding online learning in the school system. And so, you know, in 2009, when all of this was created, the city, when I joined Tweed, the city had actually already had a pretty robust instructional technology office, and they had kind of like an online learning A-team. And then as iZone was created and iLearn emerged as a core project from there, you know, some of those folks were moved around and shuffled, but it was all in support of kind of iLearn NYC innovation and bolstering the instructional expertise at the city's IT division, at the DOE's IT division, DIIT. But, you know, when you look at the current administration, it doesn't seem like instructional tech or online learning have really been much of a priority.
So, in other words, you fault the DOE for not having a real division of expert people who are running the show in terms of online learning and who can help support teachers to adopt these various platforms and commercially prepared courses and teach them how to selectively draw from those courses in order to bolster their own instruction. But I must admit, I'm quite a skeptic about online learning in general. I've looked at the research. I'm actually helping to prepare a guide to online learning for parents. The research is pretty clear that for most students, online learning, even blended learning, does not work as well for students as in-person learning does. And the theory behind this, or the experience of teachers, is that learning is essentially a social endeavor that is driven by human interaction for most kids, And that's why so many of them seem to become alienated and even depressed when their schooling is dominated by screen-based learning, remote learning, or these commercially prepared programs where there is such little human interaction. From your, you know, years of experience with this, what is your advice to teachers and parents who are trying to keep their students engaged while learning online? What sort of innovations and or strategies should they use to keep kids interested in the pursuit of learning when they're online?
Sure. You know, I think there's a few things from with a parent, and I'm saying this as a parent with a child in the other room, sixth grader, who's, you know, logging onto his school's orientation right now as we speak. You know, I think you're right insofar as like this, the social matters, the quality of the relationship that play matters immensely. And so first and foremost, like establishing confident communication channels with your child's teacher, first and foremost, is really, really important. So one of the things that we do in the class that I launched on Inside Schools Plus is there's literally like a, there's an instrument, there's a tool that helps families walk through like, what are all the ways you're getting messages from your school, from the administration and from the teachers? What are, you know, some of it's email, some of it's a robocall, some of it's whatever, Google Classroom notifications, whatever it might be. But really taking stock of like, what are all the ways folks are trying to communicate with us? And how do I make sure, as the parent, especially, or as an older student, that I have a communication line open, with the teachers? You know, another bit of advice is to absolutely like sit down with students and help them explain to you what they think the expectations are, what they think the assignments are. What's due when? What are all the systems you're looking at? Does it all make sense? And help them make schedules that mean something to them. And I would say on a day-to-day basis, just to manage the fact that a lot, like all of the expectations are all over the place, even in some of the best prepared schools. You know, in addition to that, as you're thinking about, you know, how do we manage all of the expectations of the assignments and all of that, it's also important to say, like, what are the kinds of more authentic learning and engaged learning, active learning that are of interest to your child, and what are some ways that you might be able to also create space and time for those sorts of endeavors? So that means, like, not just putting on the schedule. I made this mistake in the spring. Whereas, like, I treated the schedules as like, all right, you know, this is where we're going to put all of your school assignments. But the fact is, like, there were other things that, like, my son wanted to do and would be quite happy to do, and other things he'd be quite happy to learn. And so what I realized in moving forward was like, okay, we actually have to, if he's, like, you know, committed to, like, launching a YouTube channel, then, you know, we got to create some space on here, on the official schedule of our family, so that it has the same weight and gravity that, you know, these other expectations do. So I think communication is absolutely key, and translating what you're seeing the expectations to be onto a schedule so that you can make sense of it, you know, whether it's an every morning meeting or it's in the evening, whatever it might be. I think all of those are really, 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 really important.
So I'd like to open up the phone lines if we can. Please call in with your questions or concerns for Tom, or to tell us about how remote learning is going for your child today so far. The number is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. As I mentioned earlier in the show, Tom, the DOE has agreed with the UFT that class sizes in the part-time remote classes will be allowed to double to 64 to 68 students per class, even though some experts and lots of teachers actually say class sizes need to be kept even smaller than normal to keep students engaged and receiving enough feedback when they're learning on screens. What's your view of this issue?
So first and foremost, I think that given the social emotional trauma that many students have experienced in the middle of this pandemic, and that's a trauma that's disproportionately affecting communities in poverty and of color, I think the focus needs to be on getting, you know, as many qualified adults as possible into students' lives systematically. So, you know, I don't know that it just comes down to class size. I think class size is an important, obviously an important mm-hmm. piece of it. But I also think that there are creative mechanisms for ensuring that other adults are involved in children's school experiences, whether that's different kinds of guidance counselors, you know, guidance counselors, school nurses. There's other kinds of, you know, of professional adults at schools who can lead clubs or do things like that. So I think getting as many adults into the school experiences of New York City's children in the coming months is going to be, you know, absolutely vital. I also think that in terms of what happens in classrooms, I do, and you're asking specifically about class size, I have a few thoughts on that. One is, I think whatever happens in terms of a child's learning experience, it comes down to the quality of curriculum design, instruction, and assessment, and the way in which those three elements are intertwined, you know, artfully in what a teacher does day to day. It's why in teacher preparation programs, there's such a heavy emphasis on, you know, at least initial curriculum design and things like that. I do think that there could be some viable models for some schools where they could come out on the other end of this and say, like, well, actually, you know, what happens if we want to get smaller class sizes, but if we have some of the limitations that we have, like, is it possible to have days where, you know, you have your roster of 34 students, let's say, but, you know, half are in the school on days when the other half are doing digital learning work, and then they, you know, they switch, let's say, 4 days a week, they alternate, and then there's a flex day of some kind. Meaning, I think there could be some models that, while perhaps not ideal, could actually be implemented relatively quickly without the sort of budgetary panic that reducing class sizes in half tends to evoke, you know, when you get into some of these conversations with different officials. So again, I do think that there could be some creative ways to learn lessons from this that might have some longer term positive effects for the system. But in response to your immediate question about the idea of having 64 to 68 students per class, I think that's a dangerous precedent. And it's also, I don't know. I wouldn't argue that it's appropriate for, what students' needs are going to be, especially the 73% of students in New York City who experience forms of poverty. I think what they need are more adults in their lives who are coordinated and intentional about the kinds of supports they're offering them.
Mm-hmm. So what about the other concern that parents often express, which is about the limits on screen time? In other words, some parents say that there wasn't enough live teaching online last spring, but other parents are concerned that some schools have schedules with up to 4 to 5 hours of live on-screen learning per day. What are your feelings about that?
Yeah. That's a great question, and I say that as a, you know, parent of a child who is on a screen more than I'm ever comfortable with. You know, what I would say first and foremost is when it comes to what schools are doing this fall with regard to their use of screens and live instruction and the way in which that they're offering to families, you know, whatever their blended or remote learning model is. Schools have created these kinds of, we'll call them programs, but they've created these in without very much direct guidance from the central offices in terms of digital learning, in terms of academics. At least that's what we hear talking with principals and with teachers. So the reason I start with that is to say, for any family who's seeing what their child's experiencing and is unsatisfied with that, you should feel comfortable reaching out to your child's teachers and principals and, you know, diplomatically sharing what some of the experiences are, sharing your concerns, and really trying to keep the communication line open to improve the quality of learning and teaching in the short term there. When it comes to screen time and limiting screen time, I say, you know, yes, yes, yes. Then I immediately say how, right? If they're not on the screen, and I'm not saying this is right, Lainey, I'm saying that this is how I've come to understand the crux of this issue. It's if students aren't on the screen with a live teacher, then the school system is putting an awful lot of responsibility directly on the shoulders of whoever else, if there's anybody else at home with the child at that moment. I would understand why, if you're trying to solve this problem quickly, why it could make sense to be like, well, we just have to have them like online with us so that, you know, we're responsible for them and we can watch out for them. Because the moment the screen shuts off, there are a lot of adults, teachers, principals, others who would say like, I don't know what's going on there. And what's going on in schools when the screen's off is inherently inequitable. And so there were those who I think have justified the idea of keeping screens on longer in the ways that you're describing. They've justified it that way. And I don't necessarily fault them for how they reach that conclusion. There are in our house, this is kind of just, again, speaking more as a parent. We require reading every day. We try to limit video game time, and we have rules around like putting devices away after dinner. You know, so we also try, if there's any opportunity to get outside, we try to go for it. But I think you're right to raise questions around the unintended dangers of excessive screen time, especially when it becomes compulsive screen time. Because your child's school is requiring so much of it.
Should hands-on learning be incorporated into remote instruction? And if so, how?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. Absolutely. Hands-on activities can be really effective when they are part, and this is a, you know, this, when they are part of a rigorous and creative curriculum. There is nothing inherently good about it. This is me talking as both a teacher, a professor, you know, my current role, like there's nothing inherently good about a hands-on activity necessarily in the context of an intentional scope and sequence and like schooling experience. Like all learning should be guided by thoughtfully designed curriculum, authentic forms of assessment, and an array of challenging, engaging activities that are meant to expand children's learning. That's online or that's offline. So, for example, I'm like, online learning does not prevent the integration of really thoughtful, hands-on, engaging activities. And some of the rich kind of hands-on, engaging activities you might have in a classroom can often be translated to an online environment very well. A Socratic seminar is a great example. Like, you can have some really rich, illuminating conversations using a basic kind of Socratic technique where you start with a question, where there's a discussion protocol, et cetera. You can absolutely do that well online with Zoom, right? But in order to set that up, teachers need support in seeing what that digital model looks like, right? You have to assign speakers at the start. So you have to have kind of like a fishbowl, as we call it, model, where some students are talking about the question to start. Then you require students who aren't in the fishbowl to take notes in a form about the conversation their peers are having in a form that they then submit, let's say using Google Classroom. You can award points if you want to for the students' use of particular questions or accountable talk stems. Like, the point is that, you know, the, like, quality teaching is quality teaching. And there's an awful lot that online learning can offer, that blended learning can offer, that face-to-face learning can offer. I would just remind folks, too, that, you know, having been in a lot of schools over the last number of years, just because kids are sitting in a classroom learning face-to-face doesn't mean what's happening in that classroom is good. and doesn't mean like that they're that they feel safe. It doesn't mean that they feel challenged or nurtured. So while I do understand in the current context the framing of kind of online versus face-to-face learning and the ways in which, especially because of how the city's handling online learning, that it can be tempting to identify it as, you know, throw it out, we should all be back in the schools in the classroom. If you're quickly in that camp, it could very well be because your child happens to have had some great teachers and has had a more or less positive experience in schools. That is not necessarily the case for many families in New York City.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you on several points that you just tried to make. I think that what the experience is of many students, even with supposedly well-designed remote learning or blended learning programs, such as the Summit Learning System, which, you know, was devised by Facebook and now CZI, Mark Zuckerberg's operation with a lot of money, has shown that kids do become alienated if they aren't interacting in a live way with other students and teachers on an ongoing basis. And that sitting in a classroom, though obviously not ideal in many cases, especially if the teacher isn't experienced, especially if the class size is too large to prevent that kind of ongoing interaction, is not what we need for our kids in general, and especially for disadvantaged kids in New York City. In general, it is a better way to learn. What the research also shows is that hands-on learning in terms of actually taking physical notes in a class, whether remote or not, and reading physical books rather than reading text online is really aids in comprehension and retention of information. So I'm hoping that whatever is done in terms of remote learning does incorporate a lot of those tools in the future.
I agree. Yeah. I just want to make sure it's clear. Like I agree with what you're saying on the I'm not advocating for, you know, just log on to Summit Learning and like and off you go and anything like that. I think the having really thoughtful social interactive components is essential. I think you're right in terms of like the ways in which we take things like reading physical books, notes, things like all of that, like absolutely has a place in any sort of quality online or blended learning model, without question.
Great. Thank you so much, Tom, for taking the time today. I hope you might come back in the future sometime later in the year when you can share your observations about how things are going and also the projects that Inside Schools is involved in. Again, thank you for being here today.
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate the
invitation. I've been talking to Tom Liam Lynch of Inside Schools and Center for New York City Affairs. This is Leonie Hameson, host of Talk Out of School on WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio. We'll post more about these issues, including the Inside School Project, Inside Schools Plus, on the WBAI website, also on the podcast site. I'm off next week, but we'll be back on September 30th with more Talk Out of School. Until then, please be careful and be safe, and thanks so much for listening.
Ring, ring goes the bell. The cook in the lunchroom's ready to sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat. You're fortunate if you have time to eat. Back in the classroom, open your books. Keep it, the teacher don't know how mean she looks. Soon as 3 o'clock rolls around, finally lay your burden down. Close up your books, get out of your seat. Down the halls and into the street. Up to the corner and round the bend. Right to the juke joint you go in. Drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you